In the coming week, Saudi Arabia hosts a virtual G20 summit. U.S. President-elect Biden ramps up his cabinet selection process, and the U.S. is set to formally withdraw from the Open Skies Treaty. It's November 19th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Well, Bob, in the coming week, Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud will chair the annual summit of the Group of 20. This year's summit was originally scheduled to take place in Riyadh, as Saudi Arabia currently holds the presidency of the G20, but instead it's going to be held virtually because of the threats posed across the world by COVID-19. Can you give us some sense, Bob, of what's going to be discussed at this year's virtual G20 summit?
Sure, Jim. First, I'll provide a little bit of the context. You know, we're sort of in a what's typical on the global diplomacy calendar year, a summit-heavy period. So you have typically the Asian summits, the ASEAN, and the various offshoot summits from those, APEC and East Asia Summit and so forth. All this is virtual, which means all of it is kind of losing a bit of its normal vibrancy and its normal sort of serendipity, frankly, where you can get leaders who can get some minutes of personal time and maybe forge some agreements that might not have been, you know, apparent going into these meetings, although they're heavily sort of scoped out ahead of time by the so-called Sherpas. With the virtual, you know, it's a little bit, again, it loses something. So what does that mean in terms of who's coming or who's going to be showing up on camera and to make speeches? At this point, the latest reports I saw show that Russia's Vladimir Putin, China's Xi Jinping, Germany's Angela Merkel will all be making speeches. It's not clear yet whether there will be an appearance from President Trump. The last I saw, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will actually be in Saudi Arabia during the summit. He's on a swing through the region as we speak, just was in Israel today as we're taping this podcast. So we'll have to see in terms of the attendance, what's going to happen. A huge backdrop to this, in addition to, you know, the Saudis not being able to make a kind of a flashy presentation in person. Of course, the world is dealing with this pandemic, which is experiencing a new wave in a number of countries. And you have these G20, the group of 20 leading economies who are in the best position of any global talking shop to do something about it, getting together and maybe weighing in with some discussion about everything from how to help out some of the weaker developing countries deal with some of their mounting debt problems to, you know, rolling out a coherent plan for distributing vaccines, which is an area of the best promise right now when you've had a couple of U.S. firms, either directly themselves or as part of a global collaboration, coming up with very promising vaccines. So will we see the group of 20 come out with a joint statement that says, we are hereby committed to X, Y, and Z related to the rollout of a vaccine in the coming months. That is probably the thing most looked for. There are other issues that the G20 typically talks about, everything from trade to climate and so forth. Those are tempered for a number of reasons, including the U.S. resistance to some of the language in the past, and also the fact that the U.S. is going through a very sort of tortuous transition process.
Well, can I draw you a bit more out on this problem of vaccine nationalism, the notion that countries may develop vaccines and not be willing to share with other countries? And you mentioned this could be a topic that comes up at the G20 virtual meeting. I'll note that at least two candidate vaccines in the United States seem to be doing very well, one by Pfizer and another by Moderna. There's another, I think it's with AstraZeneca in Great Britain, that is doing well. The Russians claim to have had one. A number of these vaccines have limitations. I believe, for example, the Pfizer vaccine requires being refrigerated at very low temperatures. And in that sense, it's not a vaccine that's easily provided to people unless you have special refrigeratory, if that's a word, capabilities.
It could be, given what's coming up, that could be a word that we use quite a bit, Jim.
Well, I just coined it. But if you could just sort of give us some sense of, you know, where we think we're going on this, because again, we have a population of 7 billion people around the world, and we're talking about doses in numbers production, 100 million, 200 million. There's a big gap there. So can you sort of help us think through that?
Yeah, and you've seized on an important point, because whether you're talking about the Pfizer collaboration, which is talking about these very low temperatures to stabilize this treatment, or the Moderna model, which from what I've read requires much higher degrees required to keep the vaccine stabilized, something on the order of what they use for chickenpox vaccines. Either case, there's a refrigeration requirement necessary. And so that's one thing. And if it is the extreme case, or at least there's a desire to create the ability to provide as many of these vaccine samples as possible, then yeah, you are going to need to have this ability to refrigerate in a bigger swath of the world and not just in the wealthiest countries, which themselves have to really ramp up this capability as well, Jim. So I think one of the things that's on the agenda is a desire to provide the wherewithal for poorer countries to provide the vaccines at lower prices and also help to fund the steps to take all the different measures to curb infections. Part and parcel of that has got to be the sort of the infrastructure to be able to distribute a stable vaccine. And by the way, both the main vaccines that are showing promising signs and tests, you know, it's a two-part thing. So that's tricky in the best of times.
I mean, you have to get two shots.
You have to get two shots. At least one of the vaccines, there is an anticipation that the first shot is something that will cause a good deal of discomfort and for some people probably disincentive to go get the second one. But it's very important that people do follow up and get both of these shots to get the best chance to get the highest level of success. Again, vaccines face their own problems in, again, the best of times. We've already seen backsliding in the United States and other countries on things like measles vaccines. Measles is actually starting to make a little bit of a comeback. It was one of the great global health success stories. And so in the case of the pandemic, where you've already had disagreements over public health steps like when to wear masks and what sort of businesses should be locked down or shut down or tempered or whatever, rolling out a vaccine is going to be a fraught process. Add to that, in the U.S. at least, the fact that you have an incoming administration that is not able to talk to the outgoing administration about, you know, public health policy. That makes it difficult. The U.S., I think there's a desire that we've seen in, from the past and what we've seen in comments going forward, that it would be great if the U.S. was in a leadership position on this. The incoming Biden administration has expressed interest in being part of a global effort. But we're at a tricky period right now, as you have sort of laid out on your blog and in discussion with CFR President Richard Haass. This is a very tricky period right now of handover and unprecedented pushback against the election result in the U.S. by the Trump administration. And so all of that is sort of fogging this issue. And you have here, you have this, in some ways, a really special opportunity, the G20, which has in the past shown an ability to kind of knit people together. I'm thinking about after the global economic crisis in 2008, to knit countries together. In that case, it was to sort of take a stand against protectionist measures, against measures that would chill global trade and commerce. Now there's a number of different messages that the G20 could be sending, but I think public health seems to be a foremost one, especially as you're seeing these numbers and these daily infection numbers and the fatality numbers grow in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Well, certainly in the U.S., we've already crossed 250,000 deaths, and expectations are that that death toll is going to mount relatively rapidly in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Jim, let's turn our attention to the U.S. then and keep on talking about the U.S. presidential transition. President-elect Biden has announced Ron Klain will be his White House chief of staff. And by the way, he has some background in public health from the Obama administration. President-elect Biden is anticipated to announce some cabinet nominees before Thanksgiving, which is next Thursday. So, Jim, set the scene for us. What do we need to know about this piece of the transition process?
Well, two general points, Bob. The first is that President-elect Joe Biden is about to start unveiling his picks for cabinet choices. And second, this transition is continuing to be a very unusual one, precisely because President Trump has refused to concede and the formal transition process hasn't been kicked off. Let me sort of break them both down. In the first point, in terms of naming cabinet officials, Vice President Biden said he hopes to begin naming some of them before Thanksgiving. Now, he began by appointing Ron Klain as his chief of staff. He's filled out a number of other positions in the White House underneath Mr. Klain. This is typical, and it's indicative of the fact that in the modern U.S. government, the White House is the center of power. We often talk about cabinet government, and political science textbooks like to talk about cabinet government, but for the most part, policy in a modern American presidency is run out of the White House. Now, looking at the appointments that President-elect Biden may make, I think a lot of people are going to be looking at to see who he picks for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, is that on the campaign trail, then-candidate Biden talked a lot about having a cabinet that looked like America. And I anticipate people are going to hold him to account on that, but he has a challenge, and the challenge has two dimensions. The first is that he has to be able to get his nominees through what looks like will be a Republican-controlled Senate. still up in the air because we have the two runoff races in Georgia. But I think the conventional wisdom is that given that Georgia historically is a red state, it's likely to go Republican. And it would be a huge upset for the Democrats to pick up not one, but both of those Senate seats. Now, if you have to get your nominees through the Republican Senate, that really sort of compresses sort of the group of people you're going to be inclined to nominate, because obviously Republican senators are going to be looking for some nominees that they can contest. Again, we live in very partisan political times. So the expectation is that President-elect Biden's going to be looking for nominees that he's pretty sure he can get through the Senate without a lot of controversy. Because again, from the vantage point of an incoming administration that has a very full inbox, you don't want to lose a lot of time in a spat over nominees. It's a distraction and it sort of takes away your political capital. But here's where the other side comes in and creates a problem for the president-elect. And that is, if you go with so-called safe nominees, that may alienate a fair number of Democrats. Again, you know, Democrats in campaign 2020 were united, but they were united fundamentally on their opposition to President Trump. They weren't united on policy matters or even on basic issues like messaging. And remember, in Washington, personnel is policy to a considerable extent. And it's safe to say that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is looking for President-elect Biden to nominate people who they think reflects their values. And so you could have some inter-party fights on that score. I think you're also going to have some people saying, well, if you want to calm down partisan tempers, maybe you should nominate someone to a cabinet position who's a Republican. You may recall that Bill Clinton did that when he nominated Bill Cohen, a Republican senator from Maine, as Secretary of Defense. Barack Obama did likewise with first Bob Gates and then Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense as well. Whatever the merits of making those kind of across-the-aisle choices, my guess is that it will alienate a fair number of Democrats who say, wait a second, we campaigned for you and people who are Democrats should get these positions. But beyond that, going back to the nuts and bolts of the transition, we still do not have the formal transition process underway. Emily Murphy, the head of the General Services Administration, has refused to issue, the technical term is, an ascertainment that we have a president-elect. And as a result of that, you can't begin the formal transition process where people on the Biden transition team meet with Trump administration officials to figure out what's going on so that the Biden people can hit the ground running come January. It's not clear when Ms. Murphy is going to give that ascertainment. There's no legal way, as best I can tell, to force her to give that ascertainment. The president has called for a recount in, I believe it's two counties in Wisconsin. He has a wide range of lawsuits that are going on, none of which, as best I can tell, have been successful thus far. As we're sitting here recording the podcast, the state of Georgia is about to announce the result of its hand recount of the election ballots, all 5 million or so. As best we know, the results are not going to be any different than what the first count produced, which was a Biden victory. But again, we sort of sit here waiting to see sort of the normal transition pieces begin to go into effect. Now, I will be the first to say that on a wide range of issues, the fact you're going to get a late start on the formal transition probably won't mean that much. But I do think in some areas, in COVID-19, pandemic treatment, the vaccines and their rollout, this could be a very big problem. Because again, what you hope to have, an ideal situation, is to have one administration essentially handing off a plan that works for the incoming administration. Think of it as a relay race. You really want a clean passing of the baton. But here you run the risk that you're not going to have communication between the existing administration, the incoming administration, and they're going to disagree on how to actually go about it, which could sort of multiply the consequences of this and mean that the vaccine rollout could be far less effective, which obviously means more cases and more deaths.
I think that is a real central point, Jim. And again, much has been made about the differences between the way Republicans view the pandemic and Democrats. Although you're starting to see increasing number of Republican governors, you know, reacting to really health crises in their states, setting up mandates on things like mask wearing, for example. But it would stand to reason that Republicans across the board, whether it's on the state level or in Congress, would like to see also a rational approach to combating this pandemic. And yet they are remaining silent amidst It's a really, what's increasingly a really difficult transition period where not only are vote recounts being called for, but it appears to be there's going to be a steady challenge of certifications and electoral votes and all the basic steps before a Biden administration can take office. And again, you're seeing in the comments that are out there in the public sphere, you know, can't the country pull together in this time at this moment over this basic issue? And it seems like it can't yet.
I think that summarizes it well, Bob. But enough about American politics. Let's shift and talk about international relations and diplomacy and talk about the 1992 Open Skies Treaty. That's an arms control agreement that the United States plans to withdraw from in the coming week. Last May, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced in a White House press statement that the United States intended to withdraw from the treaty. It would only reconsider our withdrawal should Russia return to full compliance. So, Bob, first off, what is the Open Skies Treaty and have the Russians begun complying with it?
Well, on the first one, Jim, it is a treaty born in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And it is one of these, what they call in the diplomatic parlance, classic confidence building measure of a treaty.
CBMs.
CBM. Unlike other arms control agreements, this one's all about the surveillance. It's not about the actual reduction of various weapons, armaments, and so forth. It's all about the information that different sides can gather to satisfy themselves that different steps are being taken by their partners, adversaries, and so forth. So it was signed in 1992, went into effect 10 years later. There's 34 countries that are states parties to it, and the U.S. obviously being one of the significant ones. And it has allowed each state party to do, on short notice, reconnaissance flights over other states' territories. These are reconnaissance flights. They collect data on military forces, activities, and so forth. Now, countries that have, say, robust satellite capabilities might need this less. And certainly countries that have skies that are seen as relatively open, the U.S. has seemed to be more of an open book than some other countries. You know, maybe it's not as important. But the initial impetus, as explained by George H.W. Bush, was to really to get a better sense of Russia. And by many accounts, they did. And again, this confidence building aspect helped to drive a new round of some arms control agreements. And as you say, Jim, this is eroding now. The U.S. is expected to withdraw from open skies next week. It's already The U.S. and the Russians have already sort of dropped out of the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. There is the New START treaty is due to expire soon if there's not a extension in February. And that would be the last of the major arms control agreements between the United States and Russia on nuclear weapons, which is kind of a chilling thought for a lot of people in the arms control community who don't want to see this trend go in the direction of growth and expansion and proliferation, but in fact, you know, bring it back under control. Now, the Trump administration has said, and a number of experts support them on this, that Russia has been violating open skies recently, especially in not permitting flights over places like Chechnya, Kaliningrad, which is this Russian enclave surrounded by all NATO countries, as well as the Georgian breakaway territories, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which Russian forces have occupied. And they're sort of seen in some places as de facto Russian statelets. There have also been problems, not just from Russia, but I think Turkey and Syria have also limited overflights on their territories. The U.S., in response to Russian limits, limited flights over Hawaii several years ago. So there's been this sort of fraying aspect to open skies, but also, as we've seen in other arms control areas, not a great deal of zeal in trying to pursue steps to kind of shore it back up. I think when you talk to people in the military spheres of any of these countries, there's a general desire to kind of keep it alive in some ways, because they do like the confidence building. They do like the knowledge of knowing what's going on and the ability to step in and just fly a reconnaissance flight and check out what's going on. So we'll have to see how this carries on in the absence of the U.S. I haven't seen anything immediately from the incoming Biden administration about trying to shore this up, although they have made announcements about trying to revive the Iran nuclear deal, for example. Again, it's another example of this trend of sort of letting post-Cold War era agreements lapse, and we'll have to see whether there's an ability to kind of revive this or not.
Well, there's certainly a desire on the part of the Biden administration to revive and restore some of the agreements that the Trump administration has left. We'll see what it is that the Biden presidency can actually accomplish.
Yeah, I've seen discussion of trying to seek a 5-year extension on the New START, which, you know, there's all sorts of issues involving verification there. And there was an attempt pre-election period of the Trump administration to come up with a deal on New START with the Russians. And it just never, I think it partly ran out of time. And the two sides hadn't really had a chance to really talk this through, and they weren't really on the same page. So, you know, it's not going to be easy. But the signals I get is that there is a desire from both the Russians and the members of the incoming Biden team to get New START continued and sort of work out something a little more permanent. And, you know, again, the Iran one is a whole other kettle of fish, so to speak, to kind of deal with. But there is this general desire to try to use multilateral frameworks and organizations and discussions to kind of forge these kind of agreements. Biden in that way is much more of a kind of a traditionalist figure than certainly the Trump administration has been. Jim, we have talked our way into the figure of the week portion of the podcast. So why don't we start with our audience figure, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. Jim, this week our audience selected Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Why did they pick President Erdogan?
I suspect, Bob, it's because they're worried about stability in the Eastern Mediterranean. On Sunday, Erdogan visited northern Cyprus. That's the portion of the island that's been occupied by Turkish forces since 1974. Not surprisingly, while he was there, Erdogan endorsed a two-state solution in Cyprus, creating essentially one country for Greek Cypriots and another for Turkish Cypriots. And just as unsurprisingly, the visit angered Cypriot and Greek leaders and raised tension in the region. Now, of course, this is a long-running dispute. Only Turkey recognizes the so-called Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. The rest of the world recognizes just the Republic of Cyprus as the sole legitimate government on the island.
And there's still, I believe, a physical wall separating the two sides.
There is the so-called Green Line.
The Green Line.
That separates the two sides. And of course, all of this takes place in a broader context of long-standing enmity between Greece and Turkey. Remember that the Greeks won their independence from Ottoman rule 2 centuries ago in bloody fighting. So the two countries have not always been on the best of terms, even though they're both NATO members. Recently, Athens and Ankara have been at odds over competing claims to natural gas deposits in the Eastern Mediterranean. We actually discussed that dispute back in September as it led to the two navies, or the navies of the two countries, circling each other in the disputed area. Erdogan's visit is consistent with what has been called his neo-Ottoman approach to foreign policy. He's been asserting Turkey's interests in the region. We've talked about his support for Azerbaijan and its war against Armenia. He's intervened in neighboring Syria. He's supporting one side in the Libyan civil war. And so, in essence, Ankara is trying to flex its muscles as a regional power. And I'll note in the case of Cyprus, Erdogan has not been fazed by the fact that the UN Security Council has called on him to reverse recent decisions he's made in Cyprus that Security Council members argue are raising tensions on the island. And just one closing thing, since I mentioned the United Nations, Cyprus is the home to the longest running peacekeeping operation in the world. Now, when I was in graduate school in the mid-1980s, I can remember helping a professor who was working on a book by gathering articles on peacekeeping operations in Cyprus. And at that time, that operation was already a decade old. So this is not a problem I think that's going to be solved anytime soon, and it could get a lot worse very quickly.
Jim, do you have a sense about these moves, these neo-Ottoman moves that you're talking about, the extent to which they're playing popularly among Turks? I mean, Erdogan has not necessarily been great for the Turkish economy, shall we say, and there's all sorts of areas where Turkey is ailing, and yet he continues to really step up his act in their sort of near abroad. Is this working for him, at least in terms of support?
Shorter answer, Bob, is yes. I mean, nationalism is a dominant theme in politics around the world today. Turkey is an example. This notion of a nationalist self-assertion that we are players plays well. And to some extent, you can argue that Erdogan's embrace of his neo-Ottoman foreign policy reflects the fact that he has economic troubles. It's a different way of providing something to the people that resonates with them. And again, Turkey is the heart of what was a great civilizational empire, the Ottoman Empire. So there's a long history there of symbols and events that can be drawn on, and a sense also of affiliation. And we talked about this in the case of Azerbaijan, in which Turks feel some connection to others in the region for historical reasons, for reasons of language and the rest, and it's a very powerful force. But what about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number, and it's the number 2,500, as in the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq is set to be 2,500 by January 15th, according to an announcement this week from the new Acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller. Now, it's interesting to follow up our discussion about Erdogan with what this means in terms of President Trump's legacy or interest in continuing to promote a policy line, which is not an interest of deploying or sort of enforcing a U.S. interest in this manner around the world, but actually reining in what he's called forever wars. Afghanistan, obviously the longest war in U.S. history in its 20th year approaching. And so 2,500 represents nearly half the current deployment of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. I should note that that announcement is not popular among a number of Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and a number of others who say it's jeopardizing the U.S. mission there, which is still ongoing. It should still be conditions-based. There have been more sort of nuanced responses from some other Republican lawmakers. Democrats also kind of mixed. Some have mentioned that it's an appropriate drawdown number. Others have said it's a decision made rashly and it's destined to cause problems for our Afghan allies. And yet other experts have pointed to the fact that this peace agreement reached earlier this year between the U.S. and the Taliban is in fact maybe just a U.S. withdrawal agreement and not necessarily an agreement that has any sort of credible chance of bringing peace to Afghanistan, and sort of the U.S. might be leaving the Afghan civilian administration sort of hanging it out to dry while retaining a smaller force that can launch counterterrorism operations.
What strikes me, Bob, is that what the Trump administration seems to be doing in Afghanistan, and again, a lot of the details remain to be revealed and ironed out, is consistent with what President-elect Biden said on the campaign trail he hoped to do in Afghanistan, was reduce the U.S. footprint to focus on counterterrorist operations. What I will note, though, is that a number of people in the military, and I think you were alluding to this, argue that if we get smaller, it's actually going to make Afghanistan more unstable. You're going to see a rapid growth of the Taliban, and it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to engage in the sort of counter-terrorist operations that the Trump administration and potentially a Biden administration seem to be focused on.
Yeah, and you also heard that response from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, sort of an unusually strong statement from him regarding a Trump administration move where he basically said, you're leaving open this country to the resurgence of terrorist forces, including the Islamic State, which has a kind of a foothold in parts of Afghanistan now and has launched some pretty awful attacks in addition to whatever the Taliban's done. It's not clear at all the extent to which Islamic State and Taliban have any common cause, and there have been reports of them actually fighting each other. However, it gets back to this 20-year or so quest to get Afghanistan standing on its feet and not become a haven for launching attacks abroad. It was the base for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden to launch the 9/11 attacks.
I suspect we're going to revisit this issue multiple times more.
Most definitely.
On the world next week.
Well, Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person, and I am going with General Salvador Cienfuegos Zepeda. He is a former Mexican defense minister, who you may recall, was arrested last month by U.S. authorities when he landed at Los Angeles International Airport. He was charged with drug trafficking after a long-term top-secret U.S. investigation allegedly uncovered ties to one of Mexico's top drug cartels. Yet this past Tuesday, U.S. authorities released General Cienfuegos and allowed him to return to Mexico. The press statement announcing his release said nothing about the charges having been a mistake. Rather, the press release stated that he was being returned, let me quote, so that he may be investigated and, if appropriate, charged under Mexican law, end quote. But quite pointedly, Mexican officials did not publicly pledge to investigate the general, let alone try him upon his return. Now, there's been a lot of press coverage of this story, and U.S. officials are quoted off the record as saying that the evidence against the general was compelling, which was why the U.S. government arrested him in the first place. Again, the charges were that he had used the Mexican military to protect one drug trafficking ring by going after the gang's rivals. So if true, in essence, he was able to play both sides of the street, that is, he could give the U.S. what it wanted, the arrest of some cartel members, as well as the seizure of drugs, while at the same time letting his favorite drug cartel flourish. So the question is, why did the charges get dropped? And it's apparently because the arrest outraged Mexican officials, both those in the Mexican military and outside the Mexican military. They viewed the arrest as violating Mexico's sovereignty. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador alleged the arrest was made for political or other reasons, and he accused the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration of meddling. In all, Bob, this looks like a terrible misstep by the Trump administration, even if there is a private agreement under which Mexico will try General Cienfuegos after some decent interval passes. I mean, to begin with, Mexican outrage over the arrest was easy to predict, and one would have thought the administration would have gamed that out before making the arrest. In some way, it's foreign policy malpractice not to anticipate the consequences of your decision. But beyond that, I think the lesson many people are going to take from the episode is that the U.S. justice system can be bullied from abroad. And I think that's true even if General Cienfuegos is eventually arrested by Mexican officials. You know, as the old saying goes, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression.
Jim, it's a great choice. And I'm going to be watching this one really closely because it's a head scratcher. It's also fascinating. The whole U.S.-Mexico dynamic continues to be very interesting and hard to predict whether or not it's bullying from Mexico or whether or not there were favors being called by AMLO, the Mexican president is known by, for the Trump administration, in part because AMLO is not to date recognized Biden as president-elect.
So here you're suggesting that AMLO may have called in a favor from President Trump?
I am. Just among the things that can't be ruled out, it's a fascinating relationship. You could also make the point, though, that AMLO had built up some, let's say, credentials by responding to Trump administration requests to keep asylum seekers in Mexico, the second safe harbor agreement. I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's an agreement that allows, instead of these would-be asylum seekers staying in the U.S., Mexico hosts them. And there's quite a lot of them. And many of them are actually Central Americans. So there is this sense of cooperation that AMLO has given, and he's been sort of regularly supportive of President Trump in a number of ways. He was one of the few leaders to visit President Trump during the pandemic as well. All those things add up to somebody who maybe had some stock that he was sort of trading on to bring this general back into Mexico. And Mexico has obviously its fraught history of dealing with official corruption, whether it relates to the drug fighting or other issues. And it does remain to be seen whether they'll do anything to prosecute the former defense secretary. Well, that's our look at the wild and woolly world next week. We'll be taking next week off to celebrate Thanksgiving here in the United States, but here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Election season continues around the world, with Burkina Faso set to hold its next general election. Indians mark the anniversary of the 2008 Mumbai terrorist attacks, and Ukraine marks an anniversary of its own, that of the Maidan uprising.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Amy Shortridge, Kyra Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.